Funding for this podcast comes from MathWorks, creators of MATLAB and Simulink software, accelerating the pace of engineering and science. Learn more at MathWorks.com.
From WBUR Boston and NPR, I'm Jane Clayson in for Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point.
You shake my nerves and you rattle my brain. Too much of love drives a man insane. You broke my will, but what a thrill.
Jerry Lee Lewis, the killer, one of the pioneers of rock and roll, rose to the top of the rock and roll world challenging Elvis for the throne. But it all came crashing down when it was revealed he married his 13-year-old cousin. Rock radio stopped playing his songs, but Jerry Lee Lewis did not step away from the piano. He kept performing and recording and came back with a country career. Now Pulitzer Prize-winning author Rick Bragg has put Jerry Lee Lewis' words into an authoritative biography. This hour on Point, the long, strange life of Jerry Lee Lewis. You can join us on air or online. What's your favorite Jerry Lee Lewis song? What do you make of his rock and roll life? We're at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. Or join us anytime at onpointradio.org or on Twitter and Facebook at On Point Radio. Joining me now from New York City is Rick Bragg, Pulitzer Prize-winning journalist and author of All Over But the Shoutin', I Am a Soldier Too, The Jessica Lynch Story, and many, many more. Professor of writing at the University of Alabama, he spent two summers interviewing Jerry Lee Lewis for his biography, Jerry Lee Lewis, His Own Story. Rick Bragg, welcome back to On Point.
No, thank you.
Nice to have you. So put this hour into perspective for us. What's the magic of Jerry Lee Lewis and his music? What makes him a rock and roll pioneer?
Well, I think part of it was just the dirt that he was born into. He was one of those Southern boys like Elvis, like Carl Perkins, like Johnny Cash, like so many others who grew up with one foot in the Pentecostal church and the other foot in honky-tonk and beer joints and kind of that old gut-bucket blues. And that's what gave us that beautiful music. With Jerry Lee, it was more than just music. It was a battle for his very soul, I think.
In what way?
He never, ever, even now, battles that question of can a man play rock and roll music and go to heaven? And, you know, he and Elvis wondered about it the same. He even asked Elvis once, thinking that he would be the one person on earth who could answer that question. Can a man play rock and roll with all, you know, for what at the time was, you know, very sexy music? Can a man play that music and still go to heaven? And Elvis turned white as stone and walked from the room. It scared him to death, and Jerry Lee has lived with that fear all his life.
So that defined those early years for Jerry Lee Lewis clearly. You talk about he was born into poverty in Depression-era Louisiana. He discovered his talent for the piano at an early age, didn't he? His dad mortgaged the farm to buy him a piano?
Yeah, probably the best investment. I think it's been called that, the best investment in American music history. He touched his first piano when he was, you know, barely in elementary school. And as he tells the story, his fingers kind of knew where to go. And you hear that with a lot of savants and a lot of people like that. But Jerry Lee sat down, touched the keys, and a song came out.
Let's hear one of them. This is the first song he recorded, actually, with Sun Records. I'd say it's a little more twangy than his biggest hits, but the piano is still the star. Here it is.
Hey, see your arms that reach to hold somebody new. While your heart keeps saying you're not mine, not mine, not mine, not mine. My troubled mind grows blue to another you'll be with. But now I'm so lonely all
How was he discovered, Rick Bragg? How was Jerry Lee Lewis discovered?
Well, if you listen to Jerry Lee, he'll tell you he discovered himself. He grew up in the Assembly of God Church, and he played in the church. But very quickly, he realized that he wanted something more from his music. So he went across the river to Natchez from his hometown in Faraday and went to Natchez and played in honky-tonks and beer joints when he was, as he says, when his legs dangled over the floor when he sat on the piano bench. I don't think he was quite that young. But when he was in his early teens, he was playing in beer joints where it wasn't unusual to have a bullet come whistling through the place, or playing in places where the patrons would give him their watches to wear on his arm because they knew that when the police raided the joint, which they invariably would, they wouldn't take the boy. Hmm. So his small breaks came night after night after night in these beer joints and honky-tonks, places like the Wagon Wheel on Highway 61. But his big break, of course, Nashville wouldn't have him. You know, Nashville told him to learn to play the guitar, and the Louisiana Hayride wouldn't have him. They told him, don't call us, we'll call you. So he went to that place where he thought that rebels made music. He went to Memphis, talked his way into Sun Studio, said he could play the piano like nobody on earth, and he wasn't going back to Faraday, Louisiana until Sam Phillips at Sun Records heard him. And first thing he recorded was Crazy Arms.
And so when you talked to him, what were his thoughts about Sun Records and that legendary record producer Sam Phillips, who made him famous?
Incredible warmth, first of all, because he understands that this was his key to the castle. But also frustration. All relationships, if you have a temper, like Jerry Lee Lewis, are eventually going to suffer a little bit. And his relationship with Sun did sour, and especially after the big scandal. And so he has hot and cold feelings, but mostly he knows that Sam Phillips and his brother Judd helped make him a rock and roll icon, and he appreciates that.
We'll get to that scandal you referred to shortly, but people who played with him over the years say he could conjure up 1,000 songs and play each one 7 ways. I read that. So his music was distinctive, to be sure, but it was his persona, Rick Bragg, and his performing style that really defined him. I love what you wrote. He would pound the keyboard like a coal fire steam engine, then kick back the bench, climb atop the piano, and work the audience like the Pentecostal preacher he almost became. I want to hear from Jerry Lee Lewis himself. Here he is in a 1977 interview recorded in Helsinki, Finland, where he was asked where he gets his sound from.
I guess the good Lord gave it to me. No, I was born and raised in Faraday, Louisiana, about 9 miles from Natchez, Mississippi, right across the river there. And gospel music, country music, blues music, gut bucket blues, and music with a beat, rock and roll, whatever you want to call it, boogie woogie. I was introduced to all of it when I was a young man. I was a kid growing up. And I guess that's where I got it.
Let's play some more music. Here's Jerry Lee Lewis, Whole Lot of Shaking Going On from the Steve Allen Show in 1957. He stands up and moves when he plays the piano in this video. He almost seems possessed. Here it is.
Now let's get real low. Yeah. All you gotta do, honey, kind of stand in one spot. Jump around just a little bit. That's when you have flat got something, you know. Now let's go. Shake! Shake! Honey, shake!
Rick Bragg, that was the song that made him a star, right? That put him on the map?
It did. It was not a smooth journey. You know, he knew that this song was his whole card. He knew that sooner or later, if he could just get it heard, get it on the radio, But after recording it, it was banned. And it was falling off the charts. And Judd Phillips and Jerry Lee went to New York to talk their way again without an appointment. Think about doing that today, just going up to a national television show, knocking on the door and saying, hey, can we go on? And but they talked their way on to the Steve Allen show. Allen heard the song ahead of time. And it hit so big, so huge, that it was too big to ban.
When did Jerry Lee Lewis feel most authentic to you while you were interviewing him?
Talking about his mama, talking about his daddy Elmo. You know, a lot of people, I think a lot of musicians dream of having the background that Jerry Lee Lewis had. He really did grow up in the Louisiana bottomland. His daddy really did crawl into the rafters of their house to beat to death some snakes. He's real, and that's why he sounds real.
We're talking about the life of Jerry Lee Lewis with his biographer, Rick Bragg, this hour. You can join the conversation. Do you remember the first time you heard Jerry Lee Lewis? Do you remember him as Dangerous? We're at 1-800-423-8255, 1-800-423-TALK. We'll go to break with the song Breathless, another hit from Sun Records released in 1958. I'm Jane Clayson, and for Tom Ashbrook, this is On Point.
I'm gonna be wherever you go. You have left. Breathless. Big-legged woman, keep your dresses down. You got something, baby.
This is On Point. I'm Jane Clayson in for Tom Ashbrook. We're talking about the life of rock pioneer Jerry Lee Lewis with his biographer Rick Bragg. Underneath us just there is a Big-Legged Woman, a great blues song that Jerry Lee released while he was still at Sun Records. You can join the conversation this hour, listeners. What do you think of Jerry Lee Lewis's crazy life? Does his music still mean something today? What's his place in rock and roll history? We're at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. You can also follow us on Twitter and find us on Facebook at On Point Radio. Rick Bragg, what was Jerry Lee Lewis's relationship with Elvis Presley?
Complicated. They were friends in the beginning. One of my favorite stories in the book is the day Elvis strolled into Sun Studios and announced to the room, I've been meaning to see that piano player. Hmm. And he walked up and he hugged Jerry Lee and asked him about a Cadillac parked outside. Asked Jerry Lee, he said, is that your car? And Jerry Lee said, yeah. And Elvis said, man, that's a beautiful car. And Jerry Lee said, well, you know, I try to keep a good car, like he'd been born in a Cadillac. And it was that little story, these two Southern boys, you know, what's important to them? Well, music, of course, and women, I guess, but mostly cars. That's what they wanted to talk about. But they became good friends. Elvis thought that Jerry Lee was a genius on the piano. But of course, it got complicated. It got harder.
Let's hear from Jerry Lee Lewis performing Hound Dog. Here he is live at the Star Club in Hamburg, Germany, 1964. As you say, Rick Bragg, there was some competition between Elvis Presley and Jerry Lee Lewis. But when Elvis was drafted into the Army, it looked like Jerry Lee Lewis was poised somewhat to assume the throne of king in rock and roll, would you say?
That is what happened, and that was not what Jerry Lee wanted. Jerry Lee didn't want the crown to be handed to him. He did not want, as Elvis did in a crowded studio in the light of day, he didn't want Elvis to walk up to him in tears and hand him the crown, which really did happen. He wanted to take it. And if you understand anything about Jerry Lee's character, you know why that was so. He wanted to wrest it from Elvis, to snatch it from him. Even though, again, they were friends. They spent time together. But he had what Jerry Lee wanted.
So it was during this time of transition, if you will, when some news broke during Jerry Lee Lewis's British tour. What happened?
Well, no one, I don't think, could have been more poised to hit the pinnacle of their profession than Jerry Lee was when he left for England. And he had been warned by people who cared about him in his career, by Sam Phillips and others, that if he took Myra, his 13-year-old wife, to London, that that could be disastrous. But first of all, you really don't want to tell Jerry Lee Lewis he can't do something. He kind of does what he wants to do, and he did it then, and he kind of does it now. You don't want to tell him he can't do something. And so he got his back up. He insisted on taking Myra. He told them he would not hide her. And they were in the air. They didn't even get through the airport before a reporter asked Myra who she was. And she said, well, I'm Jerry Lee's wife. And over the next few days, you know, to say he was crucified would be a cliche, but it was not far from that.
I'm curious what his attitude is about that now, these many years later, that marriage, that very obviously controversial marriage to the 13-year-old first cousin.
The truth is, it's one of the few things he gets mad about when I was talking to him. And the anger is not bringing it up. The anger is in that he still doesn't understand what the big deal was. In his culture, to marry that young was commonplace. In his culture, and again, even in the 1950s, in his culture, to marry a cousin. In his family, if cousins had not married cousins, that whole family probably wouldn't have survived. They were intertwined so much that you could be someone's, you know, cousin, brother-in-law, and uncle at the same time. And I'm not kidding. It was just not unusual to marry your kin. And Jerry Lee believed Myra was a grown woman. And the one thing that makes him kind of burn now deep in his stomach is the notion that he somehow coerced or robbed the cradle.
Here he is in 1958. Jerry Lee Lewis, when his tour was cut short and he returned to the United States after news that he was married to his 13-year-old first cousin. In this interview, Jerry Lee Lewis and his wife, Myra Gale Brown, were asked about their reception over there in England.
The papers reported that you were greeted with silence over there and with catcalls from the audience. Is that right?
Well, I can't agree with them there, sir. Our audience was very nice and very good.
Mm-hmm. Were you there, Mrs. Lewis?
I was there, but I wasn't at the shows.
Oh, you weren't at the shows?
Mm-hmm.
Oh, did you notice anything like that, that sort of reception?
No, it was a very good reception, I thought.
Well, why did you leave?
Well, I don't answer those questions, sir. My manager might knock my head off or something.
when were you married?
Pardon?
When were you married?
We leave our personal questions out of this, sir.
Rick Bragg, did he worry that that would take him down, it would take his career down, or did it not matter?
Well, the whole time he was in England, he refused to accept that it was the fans, that it was the people who came to his shows that were against him. He saw it as something that the newspapers, that the headlines were doing to him. When he came back, he just would not admit that it had done him any lasting harm. He just wouldn't admit it. And to this day, he refuses really to accept that the fans, the people who bought his records, were at the start of this. He sees it more as something that grew from the headlines, from that onslaught. And he's probably not completely off on that point, not completely. But he still refuses to concede that he did anything wrong.
Let's go to Joanne in Milwaukee, Wisconsin. Hi, Joanne. Glad you called. Welcome to One Point. Hi.
Hi. I just wanted to say that I'm an old lady. I've been following Jerry for over 40 years, actually probably over 50 years. I finally got to see him in New Orleans about 10 years ago. When he walked on stage, I said, no, that's not Jerry. He wasn't the man I thought he was. He sat down at the piano and he played for 2 hours. The man is the most fantastic man I know. My favorite song is "She Even Woke Me Up to Say Goodbye," and he didn't sing it.
Oh no!
I just wish people would really realize, even now, the talent that man has. It's unbelievable.
Joanne, thanks for the memory. I really appreciate the call. Rick Bragg, I've heard what Joanne said from many people, that they'd heard him live in his later years, and he'd sit down, and he looked a little kind of elderly and not quite there, and then he started playing, and he started playing, and boy, he came alive.
Yeah, it is the one thing that it's almost spooky. I talked to a lawyer in Nashville who told me that he came to see Jerry Lee Lewis play, and Jerry Lee stepped out on stage, and he was pale. He looked a little worse for wear. You know, the hard living is – Jerry Lee's a veteran of hard living. And
to say the least, Rick Bragg.
Right, to say the least. So I'm trying to be kind. And he walked out on stage, and he looked rough, and then he sat down and played for 3.5 hours. And the lawyer said, you know, he played every song I've ever heard in my life, including Jingle Bells and the Easter Bunny song. And it was July. He said it was like watching a jet plane take off. You know, you kind of take off slow and then you gain momentum. Jerry Lee loves that piano. And he loves the stage. And as long as there's a piano and a stage to sit it on, he probably will live forever.
As you've said, he's a complicated guy, and he was in many ways as hard to tame as his music. I like the phrase used to describe him as unrepentant outrageousness. His cousin was Jimmy Swaggart, who spent a lifetime condemning rock and roll. Jerry Lee Lewis embraced its temptations. What were some of the excesses that he came to be known for?
Well, how long we got.
Not that long.
Right. Well, you know, there were the women.
Yeah, married 7 times.
Married 7 times, but then there were the ones in between, and he would sit at the piano stool sometimes and turn away for a minute, and he'd look back, and someone would have placed a .45 caliber bullet on the lid of the piano. It happened more than once. Just to tell him that maybe he needed to stay away from those men's wives. You know, and any other person, if they saw a bullet sitting on the lid of their piano, might know exactly where it came from. Jerry Lee, it could have been any number of people. But there was that, and, you know, he drank a little bit. He doesn't believe he drank as much as he has been given credit for. But the pills, which he began to take when he was just a kid, the truck drivers would tip the band in the honky-tonks he played in little white pills. And to play all night, he would reach in his shirt pocket and toss one into the air and catch it in his mouth and keep on playing. And pills were with him to get him up and bring him down all his life, all his performing life. And then later, painkillers. You know, he ruined his stomach and almost killed himself with pills and with excess, and then used, you know, painkillers to basically to keep playing, whatever he had to do to keep playing, whatever he had to do to sit on that stool for 3 or 4 hours, he would do. And it, you know, his obit's been written, God,
many times. Yeah. Let's go back to the phones. Miami, Florida. Dave is there. Hi, Dave. Welcome to On Point.
Hi, Jane. Good to hear your show. A friend of mine called me and said, you better listen to radio. They're talking about your buddy.
Glad you're with us.
I had the pleasure of producing Jerry Lee in 1986 in New Orleans for HBO's Cinemax Sessions. It was his old friend, Fats Domino in France. Fats Domino, Jerry Lee Lewis, Ray Charles. And we had a piano player named Ronnie Wood from the Stones, and Paul Schaefer was the music director. And it was funny because in one of the interviews we did transitions at the bar, Jerry Lee said, yeah, I raised Ronnie Wood, because apparently Ronnie had been listening to him when he was like 14 in England when the troubles began. But you know, Jerry Lee was a pleasure. He was a hardworking man and a good friend. So I'm glad to see a book written about him.
Dave, do you remember some of the antics that became emblematic of Jerry Lee Lewis? You know, the times when he set the piano on fire that one time and he kept playing. I know, I'm sure there are others.
Well, there's a story with him and Doug Kershaw that I don't know if anybody's ever heard, where he and Doug and somebody else was on a big country tour and they were fighting over who would end the show. And it would go back and forth. And so Jerry Lee got to end it, and Doug didn't like that. Doug was famous for Louisiana Man and some other stuff, another Louisiana boy actually raised in the swamps. And so he poured a Coca-Cola in Jerry's piano and walked off the stage, and the piano's kind of doesn't like that very much, but Jerry paid it anyway. And the next night he had his roadie cut a leg where all he had to do was hit it and it would fall down. He did that, so the piano's laying at a 45-degree angle. Jerry played that. So the third night, Doug had a glass full of gasoline that he had sitting there, a paper cup, and when he finished his set, he knocked that over to the piano and he threw a cigarette there and lit it on fire. And Jerry couldn't play that. So ended the tour. That was Jerry Lee. But Jerry Lee is funny. In my show, we did two complete shows, and Jerry Lee wanted to spice it up a little bit in the second show, and he said, can I destroy the piano? And I said, no, you can't do that. Ray Charles had to play it after he played it. And I said, in the finale, you can kill the Yamaha if you want to. In the finale, Fats got the Steinway. Ray had a Fender 88 that we was famous for. And Jerry Lee had the Yamaha. And he looked at me and said, nah, Yamahas are too hard to kill.
Dave, I'm so glad you called. Thank you very much.
Yeah.
Rick Bragg, that piano fire, lighting the piano on fire story, I've heard in many different accounts, including in your book. There was talk that he wanted to end his show with Chuck Berry. He was a headliner for Chuck Berry, right? He wanted to end the show in a way that Chuck Berry could not possibly follow, right?
Well, they had argued on these package tours, these rock and roll package tours. They had always argued over who would finish the show. Jerry Lee believes that no one can follow him. And he's not far off there either. But, you know, Chuck Berry also, you know, rock and roll great. And Berry insisted on closing this one show. I think it was in New York, but I'm not real sure. That also is up to debate on exactly where it was. But, Jerry Lee did his set, took out a bottle of gasoline and set the thing on fire, walked out and said, follow that, Chuck.
We're talking about the life of Jerry Lee Lewis with his biographer, Rick Bragg. You can join the conversation. When you hear the name Jerry Lee Lewis, what songs come to your mind? Have you ever seen him live? We're at 1-800-423-8255. We'll go out to break here with How's My Ex Treating You from Jerry Lee Lewis's 1969 album, Golden Cream of Country. I'm Jane Clayson in for Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.
Your two arms will never keep her satisfied. She'll use you just the way you use me too. But up to now, how's my ex?
somewhere over the rainbow, bluebirds fly.
This is On Point. I'm Jane Clayson, in for Tom Ashbrook. That's Jerry Lee Lewis. In 1980, his big hit, Somewhere Over the Rainbow. We're talking about the life of Jerry Lee Lewis with his biographer, Rick Bragg. You can join the conversation. Are you amazed that Jerry Lee Lewis is still playing today? What do you hear in his crazy life story? We're at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. You can also follow us on Twitter and find us on Facebook at On Point Radio. Rick Bragg, Jerry Lee Lewis sort of reinvented himself, didn't he, with a country music career. Tell us about that.
Well, I think that, you know, when people say that Jerry Lee Lewis went country, and a lot of old rock and rollers did, a lot of old rock and rollers saw that as, you know, a way to keep their careers viable. But Jerry Lee had never left country. You know, his first recorded song was Crazy Arms, and he'd never been very far from country, and there was often country on a B-side of his rock and roll records. And he somehow had the ability to make everything, you know, country or rock and roll or even gospel, make it sound like you were hearing it in a place with blue, thick cigarette smoke hanging in the air and the smell of jug perfume, you know, evening in Paris and you know, in the air and old beer on the floor. He had that ability to make everything have a taste of honky-tonk in it. And that fit beautifully with kind of a, what they called hard country, country that wasn't so sappy. In the late 60s, he was looking for a hit and had been looking for a hit for a long time, and found it with a beautiful song called Another Place, Another Time. And the people who had loved him, the old rock and roll fans, you know, had gotten older, and they were just trying to get their Buick Riviera paid for. They were not raising Cain anymore, you know, in the honky-tonks. They were raising families, and they were working hard, and they went with him. But through it all, no matter what genre it was, rock and roll or country, there was that piano. Hmm. And people remembered that rolling, thumping lick, you know, that was so unmistakably him. It was like going home to follow him over to country.
Hmm. Let's go to Michael in Winooski, Vermont. Hi, Michael. Welcome to the program. Thanks for calling.
Hi, Jane. Thank you. 1970, I was in the Navy in going to school. I just finished boot camp, and so the Navy would provide some entertainment periodically on a Friday night. And so I go over to the Enlisted Men's Club this one evening, and they're having, you know, inexpensive beer and hamburgers or whatever, you know, whatever it is that you can buy, and some entertainment. So it's a big hall, and at the one end of the hall is a stage, and this band has just finished setting up, and they're starting to play. And I'm getting my sandwich and, you know, hamburger and a beer, whatever I'm getting. And I hear it's Jerry Lee Lewis. And I turn around, and he's playing. So I grab my sandwich and beer and walk down to the front table. There's nobody around me. And I'm sitting right below him at, you know, a first row seat. And I had, for about 10 minutes, probably a personal concert. There was not one other person around me. It was great. And he went crazy. He played Good Golly Miss Molly, Great Balls of Fire. He was, you know, playing with his heels and doing all the crazy stuff that he did. And I just looked up and waved at him and said, you're great. So thanks. It was just a hoot just to be able to see him play. And most of the other people that were the enlisted guys, they were all a few years younger than me, so they may not even have known who he was. But, boy, as soon as he started playing, I knew,
you knew.
I knew it was him.
Yeah.
It was really a lot of fun. And I've remembered that all these years. So anytime I hear some Jerry Lee Lewis song or story, I immediately think of that. So that was a lot of fun.
I love it. I'm so glad you called, Michael. Thank you. Here's another call from Norfolk, Virginia. Hi, Mike. You're on point. Welcome.
Yeah, hi, Jane. Thank you. Rick, I'm a big fan of your writing. Have followed it for many years.
Thank you.
Another writer I really like a lot, and I'm sure you know of him, Richard Ben Kramer.
Sure.
From Rolling Stone, right?
You got it. Well, he started out with Philadelphia Inquirer, and he was just a regular news reporter, and then he decided he wanted to try feature writing. And the first story he ever did was he went down to where Jerry Lee Lewis lived, and long story short, and I'm sure Rick knows about this, and I'd like him to comment on it, is Ben Kramer dug up basically a long story on the very dark, deeply disturbing side of Jerry Lee Lewis, alleging a series of beatings, domestic abuse, even murder of a series of girlfriends and wives that was sort of kept quiet by the local authorities and such, who were his kind of lifelong buddies and his fiefdom. I wonder what Rick's thoughts on that.
Mike, thank you. Rick Bragg.
Yeah, I think a series of anything in that is greatly exaggerated. There was the case that Ben Kramer wrote about where Jerry Lee was in the house with one of his wives when she had an overdose. And the story alleged that Jerry Lee had been complicit in that, and that it was a murder that was covered up by the good old boy network there and law enforcement. We talked with Jerry Lee about it at length, and even after the story, prosecutors said over and over again that there was never any evidence that would cause them to not only to charge Jerry Lee, but to even dig any deeper into it.
Well, they did say that, but it was a classic 1984 essay where Richard Kramer did lay out that case with plenty of tough, compelling allegations about this very disturbing murder of his fifth wife.
Right. And the truth is that as has been said, anyone who entered that world of, and again, the book is, you know, goes in detail into this, anybody who enters that world of drug use and this very dark world that swirled around Jerry Lee Lewis at that time is at risk. And we don't pull any punches in that what risk that lie presented.
Well, I think there's still plenty of unanswered questions, to be sure.
There, maybe so. And please, I'm not going to be an apologist for that lifestyle. But to assume that Jerry Lee Lewis could pull a string in that part of the world to absolve himself of murder is a little far-fetched. Nobody spent more time in jail for smaller things than, you know, Jerry Lee. Jerry Lee was always in trouble, but not big trouble. And in this case, it was the lifestyle that certainly caused this death. But if I remember right, the story alleged that Jerry Lee killed her outright. And I asked Jerry Lee that. He called it ridiculous. I asked him again. He called it ridiculous. I could probably ask him 50 times, and he would still say the same thing.
Let's go to Patricia in Ottawa, Ontario, Canada. Hi, Patricia. Welcome to the program.
Hi, Jane. I just wanted to say I saw Jerry Lee on Letterman last night, and I felt like the woman that said, oh, she saw this old man, but as soon as he started playing, oh, my gosh, it was just wonderful. You know, it was just wonderful. I don't know how I'm 73, so I don't know how we all lived through that time, I swear, but he is just great. I can't even put my finger on what would be my favorite song, but last night, called my attention to how great he still really is, and I'm going to go buy the book. Thank you very much.
Patricia, thank you. Rick Bragg, what was the interviewing process like for this over the course of a couple of summers? From everything I've read about Jerry Lee Lewis and from your book, he doesn't seem like the kind of guy who makes it easy to write about him. How would you describe your rapport?
Well, it was mostly good. There were times when we talked about things like death, where remembering would be so awful that he would physically turn away. He had everything from pneumonia to a compound fracture in his leg to crippling arthritis that required him to be in the bed. Sitting up was too painful, so I pulled a rocking chair up next to his bed, and, you know, day after day after day, we talked about the past. And we talked about, you know, the saddest of things, people he'd lost and two sons who, you know, a toddler son who drowned and an older son who was killed in an auto accident. And we talked about more than that. And some days we laughed out loud. And one day I was actually, his caregiver poked her head in to the room and said, "I've got to run an errand. Will you be here?" And I said, "Sure." And as soon as she was out the door, it occurred to me, oh, my God, I'm responsible for Jerry Lee Lewis.
As you say, many of your interviews happened in his bedroom, which, as I understand it, was reinforced with iron bars. He keeps a small arsenal of weapons in his bedroom. The walls and the furniture show signs of some sort of indoor target practice, if you will. Did you have any reservation about being alone in there with him?
Well, you know, a little bit at first. I knew that, for instance, going in, that he had shot his bass player in the chest with a 357 Magnum. Didn't kill him. Jerry Lee still says that he's not necessarily certain that the bullet went in the guy, that it might have been a piece of glass from a Coke bottle that the bullet passed through. But I thought, well, you know, I'm in no danger because, you know, that was an accident. And then I got to thinking, well, wait a minute. You know, if you shoot your bass player, why not shoot a book writer? And that could be an accident too. So, yeah, there was a moment or two where I thought to myself, well, if I make him mad, I need to have a way out of here. And with bars on the door, that could be hard. But there were some bullet holes here and there, and he showed me his 357, which he kept under a pillow. And I told him, look, you know, Mr. Lewis, you can load that 357 with 38 shells and you won't blow such big holes in things like your biographer. And but he told me he didn't think he'd do that.
Here's some more music off the new album Rock and Roll Time, released yesterday. And here is the title track from Jerry Lee Lewis.
Do I look like a loser? Do I stand in your way? A threat to your future you planned yesterday. Well, I fought for my freedom. Some called it a crime. Convicted of running on rock and roll time. I said rock and roll time. Please take me away to the whiskey and wine. Of some better day. And sometimes it seems I'm falling behind. Remember I'm running.
Rick Bragg, what was most surprising to you during your time with Jerry Lee Lewis?
Well, you know, you can't really be surprised by anything that's outrageous. And you can't really be surprised by anything that's dark. Jerry Lee had a darkness that swirled around him much of his time. And he had an addiction that rode his back most of his life. And he also had a temper. He hit several men in the face with the butt end of a microphone because they challenged the stage. They insulted him from the crowd, and he was a fighter and a drinker. He did a lot of drugs, and he did kind of what he wanted to do most of the time. And so none of that surprised me. None of the darkness surprised me. What surprised me was that, you know, he would weep over the death of a chihuahua. That he would... My mother had a heart attack during the interviewing for the book, and I had to go home, and I was outside the operating room, and the phone rings, and it's the killer speaking, and he just wanted to check and see how she was. So he didn't have to do that either. So, yeah, like I said, he's complicated.
For sure. Rick Bragg, Pulitzer Prize-winning journalist and author of Jerry Lee Lewis, His Own Story. We're going to go out on Mississippi Kid from the new album Rock and Roll Time, out just yesterday. Rick, thank you very much for your time.
Oh, it's my pleasure.
I'm Jane Clayson, and for Tom Ashbrook, this is On Point.
On Point is a production of WBUR Boston and NPR.